Good morning. I'm speaking with Miriam Pemberton about her new book, Six Stops on the National Security Tour, Rethinking Warfare Economies. Miriam Pemberton has studied the U.S. military economy and the means of shrinking it down to size for decades, first as director of the National Commission for Economic Conversion and Disarmament, and then as a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. With William Hartung, she edited Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and headed up the team that produced three successive versions of Military versus Climate Security, The Budgets Compared. Welcome to KABU, Miriam Pemberton.
Thanks so much.
Well, Congress recently passed close to a $1 trillion military budget, which is almost $40 billion more than what the Biden administration requested, already the largest military budget in U.S. history. To understand how this military budget grew to historic proportions, you write about how the warfare economy is woven into every fabric of American society and is designed to perpetuate itself. Can you describe how this integrated warfare economy of military bases, nuclear weapons labs, missile silos, and military and high-tech surveillance production sites extend far beyond the Washington, D.C. beltway into every state of the Union and in every congressional district as well?
So much of this military reach was established by World War II. So one chapter in the book, I go to Los Alamos, which is, you know, high up on a mesa in New Mexico and where the Manhattan Project started developing the first nuclear weapons and, of course, is now still up there. They had a moment after the Cold War ended when they were really seriously considering, do we really need these nuclear weapons labs now that the Soviet Union has collapsed? But, you know, those thoughts went away, and so they're still very much in the business. After World War II, there was a period when some of the military contractors who had supplied the weapons for World War II went back to what they'd originally been working on. For example, GM, you know, turned from cars to tanks and then back to cars again. Then we had, you know, the Cold War, and a lot of the companies supplying the Cold War were companies who had never done anything else besides military production. There, with the Cold War, began the new idea that we needed a permanent war economy, not just a war economy for the wars we were fighting, but, you know, this permanent ability to project our power through military force. Then at the end of the Cold War, this whole enormous infrastructure of military production and bases and the rest were kind of felt endangered. You know, do we really need all this stuff? And so they developed or they strengthened this a strategy of instead of, you know, placing military facilities and production facilities where they needed to be, they instead began spreading military contracts in as many congressional districts as they could. So the largest weapons system in the world, this is this F-35 fighter jet. The company Lockheed Martin advertises on its website that it is built in 45 states. And, you know, they brag about it. And so, you know, this is obviously not a recipe for industrial efficiency, but it is a recipe for political protection. So the more places that feel that they must have high military spending so that they can protect the jobs in their districts, the more this sort of circle is completed, and you know, there's this, you know, very potent way of keeping military budgets high, not higher than any time in our history, because that was World War II, but any time since then.
And it seems like this Lockheed Martin example you gave really illustrates how these companies or contractors keep the funds rolling in. The F-35 fighter jet you mentioned, I bet they don't brag on their website how they keep going back to the drawing board and they've been working on this fighter jet for over 30 years.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think there are two responses that are in the book to sort of come back on this political strategy. So one is a series of studies by economists who have shown if you plug a lot of military spending into, you know, all these congressional districts, you are going to create a lot of jobs. That's just inevitable. But these economic studies show that you're actually creating fewer jobs from military spending than you are if you put that money into, for example, education or healthcare or clean energy. And the other thing I discovered while I was doing the research was kept finding places I was going, such as Los Alamos, where the lab, the national lab is, has one of the highest per capita incomes in the country. And then at the bottom of this mesa is where the adjacent county is, has one of the lowest per capita incomes. So I looked fairly systematically at the most defense-dependent counties and states and compared them to the national average poverty rate, and found that in more than half the cases, this place where concentrated military spending was, the poverty rate was higher than the national average. You know, there is this prosperity gospel of military spending. You need more military spending because it builds prosperity. And what I found was there are a lot of holes in that argument.
Yeah, that's one of the many myths that you explode in this book. And I want to get back to Los Alamos and the fact that you frame your study as a tour. And of course, this tour is different from any other guidebook in that it takes us to these six different sites that represent different dimensions of the Pentagon's reach. And you include places like Los Alamos in Southern California, which might be expected as sites of military dependence. But what about some of the other places you discuss, like Pine Bluff, Arkansas, or some of the other places that would be unfamiliar to most readers when they think about the military-industrial complex?
Yeah. So Pine Bluff, Arkansas is this kind of destitute place in the poorest quadrant of one of the poorest states in America, namely Arkansas. And it's where the U.S. created its chemical weapons stockpiles during World War II. And then they, you know, kept on making them until we had the Chemical Weapons Convention that banned chemical weapons around the world. And so suddenly this base was kind of out of business. And so then they had to figure out, you know, what else do we do? And the places I visited, in each case, they had something else going for them that they could use to create economic development. And in particular, I was looking for, you know, in my view, the most important national security challenge we have in front of us, and every other kind of challenge is climate change. And so, you know, I looked at places where there were opportunities to transition, you know, the military production to something that will actually help us address the climate crisis. And then in the case of Pine Bluff, this is out in the middle of nowhere, an enormous laboratory. It's the only Food and Drug Administration lab outside of D.C. Started out in the middle of nowhere next to this chemical weapons production facility to develop chemical weapons designs. And then in the 70s, actually it was Richard Nixon who decided, no, it's going to now convert itself and work on figuring out, you know, what chemicals in our environment are potentially hazardous to our health. And so there's a possibility of using that lab to develop technologies that could become, you know, economic development moneymakers for this very destitute community. It hasn't really happened yet, but it's a possibility.
And that seems to be an important way to convince people that by redeploying those resources that currently go into the military-industrial complex, that we could use those resources in ways to prevent catastrophic climate change and also make sure that these communities are repurposed to pursue climate and human needs. This is Lori Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm speaking with Miriam Pemberton about her book, Six Stops on the National Security Tour, Rethinking Warfare Economies. And Miriam, you, in addition to referring to how this national security apparatus, military spending, permeates almost every state, and how contractors ingeniously or deviously created that kind of web, even though that's very inefficient, but just to make sure that they have the votes in Congress to keep the money flowing. But how is this language of national security manipulated to create this kind of web of military spending and political support?
The term national security didn't really exist until after World War II. I would say there's no more popular way to get support for national policy beyond calling it a national security necessity. So national security is, it's never really been defined. And if you can't define it, you know, how do you figure out how much to spend on it? As I said in the book, when you're talking about security, the argument for more money always starts out ahead because everyone wants security. But, you know, I make the argument that, you know, national security has become this kind of talismanic power that is being wielded to protect spending that really ought to be spent on other things.
Right, rather than 750 military bases around the world and larger military budget than the 12 following countries combined.
Yes, the military budget is so complicated by design that it's the only federal agency that still cannot pass an audit. They think maybe this government department can successfully get through an audit by maybe 2025, and they've been working on it for about 10 years. So we'll wait and see. You know, meanwhile, the complexities of that budget just proliferate so that it's really hard to figure out what we are spending and how much we're spending. And that is, again, I think, by design.
Yeah, as you point out, and you have graphs in your book that reveal how, even though with slight dips after various wars, whether World War II or Vietnam or Iraq, Afghanistan, the spending then skyrockets up. And so there's right. this steady upward trajectory. And as you point out, these levels don't include or reveal so many other hidden costs. For example, nuclear weaponry that's hidden in the Department of Energy budget, and on and on and on. So what by traditional metrics tell us that the military budget is the largest component of the U.S. budget outside of Social Security, there are many more costs that can't even be counted.
Yep. The military budget always is roughly equivalent to the rest of the budget. All those different expenditures on the civilian side of the budget put together.
Well, just to wrap up here, Miriam Pemberton, we know that Congress members Barbara Lee and Mark Pocan have been trying to push Congress to move at least 10% of military funding to fund urgent human and environmental needs. And they've created this Defense Spending Reduction Caucus in Congress. But that's still just moving 10% of the military funding. Which, of course, has increased many more times than that over the last 50 years. What do you think of that movement in Congress?
It's certainly has had a setback with Putin invading Ukraine, has created a, you know, an explosion of military spending around the world, not just for the United States, but of course the United States spending dwarfs every other country. And I think, you know, a 10% cut is a good place to start. There are lots of very detailed accounts of what could be cut with no sacrifice to national security. And then with respect to what I think needs to be our new national industrial policy focused on climate change, we got a good beginning, I think, for a climate-focused industrial policy in the Inflation Reduction Act that was just passed. But the amount that's going to go to clean energy and transport infrastructure with that policy and with that new funding is less than 5% of what we will be continuing to spend on the military. And I think those are misplaced priorities.
They certainly are. And thank you again, Miriam Pemberton, Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, for joining us today on KBOO and for your excellent book that I recommend to everyone as a must read, Six Stops on the National Security Tour, Rethinking Warfare Economies.
Thanks so much for having me.